get out of the way and let him talk. Not that I'm going to get off of the stool. I can't get out anyway. But, Tony, we'd like to welcome you.
Give it a good hand.
Hi. My name is Tony. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know if anyone can see at the back here, but I have to be careful because I've snapped the tendon in my left leg, so... So I have to keep... If I drop dead from a thrombosis, because I'm told by the doctor that I've got to keep my leg up. Being an alcoholic, I defy those orders, so... So I try and stand as much as I can, and my leg's gone to sleep now. Like my head used to go to sleep many years ago. But anyway... I'll try and settle in here and see if I... Are you okay there, Grant?
Oh, yes, I'm fine.
Okay, well, I'll try and do the best I can. As I said, my name, I'm an alcoholic. And a day at a time, I've been sober just over 22 years. I don't say that to impress you. It certainly impresses me that I stay... because I couldn't stay sober for more than 22 minutes. And... That's a lie. I mean, I could actually stay dry for 6 weeks. That was the limit for me when I used to try and stay dry on my own. And I'd better put that there. Anyway, where shall I start? I guess at the beginning. Oh, no, I'll start at the end, in fact. Talking about alcoholism and alcoholic personality. The thing that saved my life when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was on December the 29th, 1975. I'll try and speak slowly because I've got a funny accent. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous December the 29th, 1975, 2 days before my natal birthday, in the Pacific Palisades Group, Los Angeles. And the speaker that night, there were two speakers, a man called Don, who was a doctor, and the other one was a man called Chuck Chamberlain. And when Chuck got up to speak that night, I realized I'd come home. It wasn't so much that, you know, Chuck C. was an alcoholic like all the rest of us, but he was a great speaker. He had a great aura about him of peace. And he described the alcoholic personality. He said that, you know, alcoholics are driven people, we are tough people, we are hard people. There is nothing, we are unstoppable people. We have great willpower. And he said for years in his life he tried to beat this problem with willpower. And my ears really picked up that night because that's what I'd given it. I'd given it my best shot. I tried to beat this with willpower. And I failed miserably all the time, as you know, that's a regular story in these groups. I don't know any of you here, I know, only met a few of you people, but I know that we're all the same, basically. We all have different personalities, we're all different kinds of alcoholic, but basically we're all alcoholic, drug addict, whatever. Had I the money or the time when I started drinking, and drugs were fashionable in those days, which they weren't, I'd have hit those as well. I drank anything I couldn't chew. And I did everything at the double, and nothing was enough for me. My thing in life was, is that all there is? Like the Peggy Lee song, is that all there is? Everything was constantly disappointing me. And when I got into AA that first night, it was one of those amazing moments. I thank God that I wasn't an intellectual, I wasn't clever, I wasn't very intelligent. I had an average brain, that was about it. But I'd been very successful in my career. Through sheer willpower, I guess. And when I heard Chuck talking that night, and the other guy, Don, they talked about the self-will run riot, and the power of denial of the alcoholic. And I can say tonight, standing here 22 years later, a manifestation of my own alcoholism, which is quite recently. I'm an actor, and I'm making a movie here. I have a friend here, Alex, who's a stunt double for me. And also an alcoholic. The Australian kind. And we were doing a stunt over there. And
the stunt double should pull the tendon in his
back. Well, it seemed a pretty trick. But anyway, what I did, I had to do this thing and I snapped the Achilles tendon. And I got up in typical alcoholic fashion, 22 years later, said, I'm okay. It's only a machine gun bullet wound, you know, don't worry about it. Went back to work and I struggled through the rest of the day. Next day I was limping around and with this broken tendon and everything was fine. So, you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Good time. A whole week passed, and my leg started to swell up, and the ankle was bruised, and I thought, well, and the nurse on the set, she said, well, I think maybe you ought to go and see the doctor in case you have a clot in there, you know, a thrombosis, and a clot can, and a clot can kind of kill you, you know. If a clot breaks away, you can, that can be it, curtains. So I went to the doctor, and he examined it, he told me to get up on the table, he pressed around on the calf, he said, you've snapped the tendon. I said, have I got a thrombosis in there? He said, no, but you've snapped the Achilles tendon. I said, oh, okay, so... What's that like? He said, well, that's very serious. Oh, is it? Yeah. I said, well, what happens if you don't have it operated in within the next 2 weeks, you're going to be crippled for the rest of your life. So I took a moment and I thought, well, I've had a good life. And I've got another leg. I've had a good career. I play Long John Silver now. So I considered this, and I said to him, I said, yeah, fine, I don't need the operation, I'm just going to go on. I said, you mean I'll limp permanently? He said, yeah.
All right.
He looked at me, he said, yeah, you're going to be lame. Your foot will atrophy. I said, no, it's no big deal. And I was hobbling back to the car, and this nurse was with me, and she said, you know, you really ought to take what he said seriously, because, you know, it's your leg, it's your health, it's more important than doing this movie. And I said, yeah, I know, but I want to go on, you know. And I phoned the producers up that night. I said, no operation, I'm just going to go on. I'll just have a limp permanently, that's all. And I was amazed that they didn't react in a kind of wonderful way, you know. I think, God, great. Here, they said, uh-huh. And 3 days later, they pounced on me. They said, you can have the operation. And it didn't occur to me, and I phoned my sponsor up in California. And I told him the story. He said, that's typical alcoholic. And it reminds me of the denial that's in our system. That was a form of denial. Because I think we're tough, resilient people. I mean, how any of us are here tonight, I don't know. I don't know how I'm alive, because I should have been dead years ago. And if I wasn't dead, I should have been in jail years ago. Life isn't fair. If it was fair, I would be dead. But I used to drive a car blacked out and still deny it. You know, I used to go down to Central Hospital in Los Angeles, you know, carrying the message down, and I'd see old guys in wheelchairs shaking, falling apart with wine sores all over them. And I said, what are you doing here? I said, it's an AA meeting. Do you want to come into an AA meeting? No, I'm just suffering from nerves, they'd say. And that's denial, you know, looking down in the gutter, face down in the gutter, and saying, you're not dying. That's what it's... And this, in a way, was a manifestation of that. In a kind of funny way. I mean, I'm glad they persuaded me to have the operation. But the point of that boring story was just to tell you that is really alcoholic behavior. And I got it done, and it's still a pain in the butt because I'm now immobilized. And for an alcoholic to be immobilized is a nightmare. So I can't get around much, but I'm stuck with this for 3 months, and I'm going back to work on Monday to do some sitting down work. And then we postpone the movie and we go back to Los Angeles. But anyway, the point of all this was, I just want to say that in that euphoria at that time, that few weeks ago, the wonderful thing about being sober is that even the possibility of being lame was exciting, because everything is exciting. I mean, I may be boring, but I've never been bored in 22 years. And I told my sponsor this joke on the phone. He says, it's like the alcoholic on the raft. You know, the alcoholic who's dying, he's on the raft, his ship has gone down, he's the only survivor, and he's bobbing around in the ocean, you know. The sun is blazing down on him, he's covered in sores, and he's dying. He's only got some water left for maybe another 2 hours, and he's dying, he's had it. In the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and this big ocean liner spots him, and it starts circling around. And it gets closer and closer, and the captain says, hold on, we're coming to get you. And the alcoholic says, which way are you going? And I guess that's it, that's what we are. But I think that's why we're such great people, because we are crazy. I remember that night when I heard Chuck C and the other guy talking, and I thought, I am insane, and I've been insane for many years, and I'm allowed out, and it's okay to be here. And that night I heard Chuck say, he said, we're here because we're not all there. He said, that's fine. And that's the great thing, because we are alive and we are enriched souls, I believe. I don't know if we're special people. I don't think we're special. I think we're cursed people. And we're truly blessed if we can get a handle on this thing called alcoholism, a day at a time. I carry around in my body and in my personality a seemingly hopeless disease, which is terminal, progressive, and will kill me. And yet, for some reason, 22 years later, I'm sitting in a meeting house in Orlando, Florida. I take it that my life is none of my business. Because I came to this country in 1974. I became an actor back in the 60s, I think it was, and full-blown alcoholic. And I came in 74 to New York, and I came to America. My intention was to make a lot of money and, you know, make the pot of gold. And the last place I expected to end up was Alcoholics Anonymous. The last place alcoholics ever want to come to is Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet, this is where I ended up. Much against my will. Much against my will. And I can't explain why that happened to me. Except I think there was one streak of decency left in me, and I'd done everything to get into a lot of trouble. I'd been through two marriages. I'm still with my second wife, and why she lived with me all those years, I wouldn't have given me more than 4 minutes of my time if I'd been her. But like we do attract some pretty remarkable people, I think. I don't know why they put up with us, but my wife put up with me through the drinking years and through sobriety. I don't know which was harder for her. And she's one of those weird moderates, you know, terminally moderate. She's in Orlando with me, and she has one glass of wine every night. I don't know why she bothers, because it's on the table for about a whole hour. She usually ends up pouring half of it down the drain. She smokes two cigarettes and doesn't bother to inhale. And I ask her sometimes, I said, why do you bother to drink? You don't even finish it. Sometimes, you know, she's walking around the house, something, you know, back in England or wherever we are, and she'll suddenly say, didn't I leave a drink somewhere? It's on the kitchen table. I always know it. And she says, how do you know? I say, I always know it. I said, how can you even have it out of your hand? She says, well, I don't need it that much of it. I said, what does it do for you if you have one drink? She says, well, it's nice. It takes the edge off. I said, what edge? But she's normal. She's not an alcoholic. She says things like, weird things like, leave it. Let it go. Forget it. I have to go on my knees every morning to ask God to help me to forget it. Because I have a long list of resentments in my mind that go back years and years. Even before I was born, I can resent anything. But those normal people tend to be, whatever normal means, my wife, I guess, tend to be easygoing, have an equanimity in their nature, and have a lot of common sense. And I respect them very much. And I have a lot of friends who are not alcoholics. They still puzzle me. I mean, I go out with some friends in London, and between four of us, we sit there at the table, maybe six sometimes. I don't go out that often, but when we do. And I watch them. They have a bottle of wine between five of them. And it's still half empty or half full when we get to leave. And that's the weird thing. I remember when I first got sober, and it was my first year, and I was traveling from New York to Los Angeles. And there was some kind of, I don't know, public holiday. It wasn't Thanksgiving, but it was something like that. Maybe 4th of July, I can't remember. And this stewardess in the plane was going around with champagne, you know? Champagne for, it may have been Thanksgiving. And she came to me, she said, do you want some champagne? I said, no, not for me, thanks. She said, well, come on, it's a special day. No. She said, well, not, I said, no. She said, why not? I said, I've got a report to work next Thursday. She looked at me, she said, I don't understand. I said, no, nor do I. I don't understand. See, nothing ever satisfied me. Nothing ever satisfied me. In the ocean of booze, nothing would ever satisfy me. Work, success, never fills the cup. I'm always wanting more. But as I'm getting older, I'm wanting less now, because I've done it all. I've had some fun. And as I said, I've never been bored in my life in these last 22 years. I never get bored. And I've learned a lot, I think, through the years of being sober. I hope I've been learning and will go on learning. I don't come to any great conclusions, because everything is pretty open-ended. I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous as an agnostic. The most amazing thing happened. I came to New York, first of all, in 1974. And to do a play. And I met this woman. It was in October 1974. And she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was drunk as a skunk and sick to death and insane. And she didn't say a thing. She did the typical AA thing. She left me alone. She just smiled a lot at me. Never mentioned it. And we started rehearsing, and we started working on this play, and we were in this big successful show for 8 or 9 months, I think. And she, Mary, she's dead now. She died sober, but she never said a thing to me. She smiled at all my stupid jokes. Sometimes she'd come over to the bar with me and have a coffee. You know, it was one of those sort of restaurant bars. And I was really puzzled by her. And somebody told me, they said, you know, Mary's an alcoholic. Now, I know that she'd gone on set to somebody, you know, tell Tony I'm an alcoholic and I'm an AA. I think that. So they passed it on that way. They said, you know Mary's an alcoholic. I said, oh, really? God, that's sad. I said, I don't see her drinking. They said, no, she doesn't drink. She's an AA. What's that, an alcoholic? Oh, I said, that lot. Yeah, that's religious. Yeah, well, she's sober anyway. I said, that's why she smokes so much. Is that why she looks... I couldn't figure it out. And I never dreamed of asking her. And then on my last few weeks in New York, I remember I was in a party. And I tried to stay dry for about 6 weeks. And I was in this party and I was drinking. And I was in bad shape. And I asked her for help. And she took me out the next day. We went out and had a meal. And she gave me some information about this weird program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said some pretty insulting things to me that a child could understand. She said, you know, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk.
Oh.
Of course, she's talking to me like this Mickey Mouse language, you know. She said, it's like taking an elevator from the top floor and you can get off at any floor you want. Or you can go right down to the basement and into hell. Or she's like taking a subway from Park Avenue right down to the Bowery. She said, you can get off anytime you want to. I thought, why is she talking to me in this fairy tale language? So she said, would you like to come to a meeting? And I said, no. Having asked for help, typical alcoholic, turned her down. But I stayed dry on my own for 5 weeks with a little help of a little bit of glass, which I didn't like much. That wasn't my scene. But I stayed sober for something, just stayed dry. And I think at that time something had happened. Something had shifted chemically in my body, and mind, whatever. I flew out to California in July 75, and I took that first drink and I hit the booze pretty bad. Then I dried out another few days, maybe a couple of weeks. Then I hit it again, and it was tequila, was the stuff I used to love, you know, tequila. And it did wonderful things for my brain, tequila. Being an agnostic or an atheist, it gave me visions of God and angels. This is hallucinogenic, the amount I was drinking. And I think by that time, my tolerance had become pretty low. My threshold had become low, and I didn't need to drink that much. And I would start to hallucinate and get these strange religious visions. They were really weird. But what it did, it softened me up for this program, because in December 1975, my wife left to go back to London. She wanted to go back to let me die, if that's what I chose to do, or give me space to die. She knew she couldn't handle me anymore, and I remember saying to her, I was driving her to the airport, I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. She said, oh yeah. I said, maybe I'll join AA, sure. And she had changed completely. She gave me the cold shoulder, and I saw her off I said, say hello to your family, and have a good flight. She said, yeah. And I realized in that moment, as she turned her back on me, that I had lost the one person I'd ever loved. She was walking away from me. And I hated her for it. But I knew what she meant. She couldn't take any more. Got in the car and I drove down to Arizona. I started my drive to Arizona. I was on my way to New Mexico to find those magic mushrooms that Carlos Castaneda. Not that I'd ever read Carlos Castaneda, because I never had the staying power to read anything very much, but I heard about these magic mushrooms and the Yaqui Indians and all that. So that's where I was headed. I wanted to get it off the planet. You know, I wanted something stronger than tequila. Anyway, I didn't get that far. I got as far as Arizona on Christmas Day, and I was staying in this lousy hotel. I phoned my wife on Christmas morning in London. I said, Happy Christmas. She said, thank you. Where are you? I said, I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. Uh-huh. No surprise at all. Well, have a good time. She put the phone down. And I drove back to California, and on the 27th of December 1975, I sat in my apartment, and I knew it was over. And I felt that loneliness that only alcoholics feel, I think. Well, I don't think we call it the market on loneliness, but I think it's a special loneliness that alcoholics feel because we're going insane. And next thing I remember, somebody phoned me, and I ended up in a party. And I was in this party sitting under a piano, which is not sort of normal behavior of social people, having a fight with another actor. And it was in Beverly Hills, and anyway, this woman picked me up and she said, come on, you're going home. And I stood outside with this friend of mine, and I said, I've lost my car. Somebody's stolen my car. He said, no, they didn't steal it. He said, you left it in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard with the engine running and the radio on. Don't you remember? I said, no. He said, somebody saw you, got in the car, drove you here, and you don't remember? I said, no. I said, all I know is that I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And I looked at those, I think they were pepper trees, and the sky, and I thought, somebody up there really likes me, because I should be dead by now. I used to do all those crazy things, drive my car in blackouts, never remembering next day where I'd been, whether I'd killed anyone. I'd always check the radiator to see if I'd any blood or anything, or damage. I don't know why they didn't catch me. The police never picked me up. And I can't remember driving, you know, over the canyons into the valley and at night. And this friend stayed with me. I went to his house and I said, I'm an alcoholic. I sort of sobered up. It was like a pilot light went on. And I stayed Sunday back at my apartment. Didn't think of phoning AA. I thought I'd give myself 24 hours to think about this, very seriously, which is very dangerous to think for an alcoholic, especially on one's own. So on the Monday, I got up and I thought, well, maybe I'm making a big thing of this. And a little voice inside prompted me, said, pick up the phone and phone Alcoholics Anonymous. I phoned them up and a woman answered the phone. And her name was Dorothy. She was an elderly woman. And I said, my name is Tony, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I said, I'm beaten. I don't think I can drink anymore. She said, that's good. I said, I feel terrible. She said, that's good. I said, I'm kind of at my wit's end. She said, that's really good. And she said, do you want me to send somebody over to see you? This was 10 o'clock in the morning. I said, no. I didn't want anyone in a white raincoat and a Bible and a bottle of scotch coming over to see me, smiling goodness all over me. I was very suspicious of this organization. I resented elderly ladies with teacups and cookies saying, hi, honey. I didn't want anything to do with that charity. I hated Christianity, church, everything about God and holiness and goodness. I thought I hated. But deep down I didn't. Of course, I wanted it. I wanted to be normal. This monkey was on my back and I couldn't get rid of it. People had told me, friends said, you know, Tony, you're so successful. You're so talented. Why do you do this to yourself? I said, do what? Can't you just cut down the drinking? And I'd look at them, that disgusted look. Are they insane? Cut down? Why? Why cut down anything? Why take half measures at anything? So I went into the central office in West Los Angeles. And I met this lady, Dorothy. And she's a woman in her 70s, I think. And I walked into this pine wood office and the smell of coffee. Beautiful, sunny California morning, Monday morning. And I said, my name is Tony, I phoned you. She said, yeah. She looked like one of those ladies out of Norman Rockwell, you know. She said, sit down. I sat down and she talked to me for a little while. And she said, what do you do? I said, I'm an actor. She said, oh, my husband was in your business. She said, he was a sound engineer in the movie business, motion picture business. She said, he nearly died of alcoholism. And she said, I came in to volunteer to answer phones. She wasn't an alcoholic herself. She's one of those, you know, very Christian women. So she talked to me about the nature of alcoholism. And I said, well, I've stopped many times, but I can't stay stopped. She said, well, that is alcoholism, honey. I said, I can stop, but I can't stay stopped. She said, that is alcoholism. And she said, it'll kill you. She said, you're a nice-looking young guy. She said, what? You don't want to kill yourself, do you? I said, no. She married. I said, yeah, I gave her my history. And I got up to go and I said, what do I do? She said, well, give me your phone number and I'll get somebody to come over and see you tonight and take you to a meeting. When they said meeting, immediately my defenses went up. I said, is it religious? She said, no. Just try it and see. And as I got up to go, she obviously saw that I was in a great dilemma. I was in an agonizing dilemma. But I knew it was over. I knew the show was over. I know that I'd been waiting for years for life to start. I was rehearsing for the big event all my life. And I was on the verge of discovering that this was the big event in my life. And she said to me very gently, she said, why don't you come home and rest? And I got all choked up and emotional. I thought it was Swallows Come Home to Capistrano. She said, just come home and rest. And then she did that hokey thing in her voice. She said, why don't you just trust in God? And everything, I knew she was going to zap me with that word. The G-O-D word. And it was like a door opened and a light went on and I thought everything I've tried with my keen alcoholic brain has failed. all my first class thinking, all my reading of Power of Positive Thinking and self-help books, all that stuff I'd done, a valiant effort to change myself hadn't actually got me out of the nightmare that I was in. Some of it had helped me to get towards it, however. And lo and behold, as she said that, I thought, well, why not? I got down on the street, and the most remarkable thing ever happened to me in my life, and it was one of those moments, and I don't say it to claim that I was special because I wasn't, but maybe it's what I needed. It was the thing that happened to Bill Wilson, but it's what I needed, I guess, because I thought I was too smart or too clever or too successful or too, I know, what I was supposed to thought I was. I really never had much of an opinion myself anyway. I never liked myself. I always thought I was stupid. But at that moment, something happened. I got down on the street, and it was the beautiful sunny morning, and a big voice deep inside me said, it's all over, and now you can start living. And it's all been for a purpose, so don't forget one moment of it. Now go about your life. And it was that clear. And the craving to drink left me that moment, 29th of December, 1975, probably about 10:45 in the morning. So much so that I got into the... And I knew what it was. It's something I'd been looking for all my life. Ever since I'd been a little kid, I came home from school at the age of 4 one afternoon, and I told my father that they... He said, what do they teach you today, sonny? My father, God rest his soul, was an alcoholic. I think he was. He died a bitter man, an unhappy man, restless. And when he drank, he did those things that we do. But he only drank in later years. But he said, what did they teach you? I said, they taught me the Lord's Prayer and 23rd Psalm. He said, a load of rubbish. Don't believe in God and all that rubbish. There's nothing there. It's all rubbish. Get out in the world. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Don't trust anyone. Do them before they can do you. That was his philosophy. He didn't really practice that because he was a softy like all of us, you know. But he tried to be tough. He was like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. Never felt he got his life right, you know. And he died sadly in 1981. Frightened and alone. And that moment, for that time, from the age of 4 right up until that night, I used to sit in cathedrals, in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York in my drunken years, looking at people praying, thinking, what the hell are they on about? What is all this? Why are they on their knees? Are these intelligent people or are they just dummies? And sure enough, that old friend of mine from 4 years of age turned on me and said, hi, I've been waiting for you. And that's what it was. That voice was like an old power. So much so that I was going up Ohio Avenue, and I stopped off and I went into this Catholic church. And I saw a priest crossing from the church into his office. So I said, could I talk to you a moment? He said, yeah, come in. I went and sat with him. I didn't know what possessed me, but he said, can I help you? I said, yeah. I was looking pretty rough. I said, I think I've found God. He said, well, congratulations. I said, well, I don't know what to do about it. I said, I told him, I'm an alcoholic and I just joined AA. He said, well, that's a good organization. He said, they're great people, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, and that's what you're looking for. If you're an alcoholic, you're in the best place. I said, is it religious? He said, well, if you found God, you shouldn't have any problem with that. See, zappy, gubby, whichever way you're doing. I was had. I couldn't get out of this fix I was in. So I went back to the apartment, and Dorothy, the woman from Central Office, phoned me up. She said, have you got any alcohol there? I said, yeah, I've got some beer. I'm pouring it away now. She said, well, just pour it down the sink. Do you want me to hold on to the phone? I said, no. So I poured it away. She said, well, somebody will phone you. And that night, a man called George phoned me, and he was everything I expected. You know, he phoned me. He did one of those mean things that Alcoholics Anonymous people do. He phoned me, Sam, my name's George. I'm an alcoholic. Is that Tony? I said, yeah. Have you had a drink today? I said, no. Because we're devious sons of bitches, all of us. He said, what's your address? So I give him the address. He said, I'll see you at 6:30. He slammed the phone down. So I couldn't get back to him. I could. So I thought, I'll go and hide. 6:30 enough, sure, the bell rang, and I went down the stairs dreading it. But I was kind of curious as well, and there was George, silver hair, crooked smile, straight teeth, and his girlfriend Lila. She was chewing gum, and we got into the car, and George smelled of aftershave lotion, and he gave me a handshake which nearly broke my hand. He said, hi, my name's George, I'm an alcoholic. I'm in with the nuts now, I'm really in it. Weird, it was born again Christians, and with all due respect, I don't want anything to do with this. It's the Salvation Army, as much as I don't want anything to do with charity and tambourines and singing hymns. I don't want anything to do with it. So we pulled into this car park in the Pacific Palisades. Ironically enough, I bought a house there recently, just up the street from there. So life has a strange way of completing the circles. And as I got out of the car, I saw this actor, this old guy, walking down from his car with his wife, with a crowd of other people. So I said to him, I said, what's he doing here? I said, I just worked with him. He said, he's an alcoholic. I said, I just worked with him last November. No, he's an alcoholic. I walked in the meeting and this old fellow said, "Hi, Tony, how are you doing?" "I've been waiting for you." I said, "Did you know?" He said, "Oh, Tony," he said, "we always know." He said, "Sit down." And then a guy called Bob came over and I sat between these two men. And that night a man called Don got up and spoke. He was the first speaker. It was an hour and a half long, the meeting. And I've got to go on for another 20 minutes. Well, Don got up and he was a surgeon from Palos Verdes. And he said, "My name's Don, I'm an alcoholic." And he looked like one. He looked like he'd been hit by a truck. The long black hair, beaten up face, and he had a voice like that. "My name's Don, I'm an alcoholic." And he said, described himself as a surgeon. "I mean, how can a surgeon?" "Yes, I'm a surgeon, you know." And he said, "My moment of awakening was when I was standing over a patient who was open." And he said, "I was about to operate, and the nurse said, 'Doctor, you've just operated, so we're upgrading.'" And everyone in the room started laughing. I thought they were all crazy. And he was laughing, everyone was laughing. I thought, "God." I thought, these people are really onto something here. They were all laughing. And then we had a coffee break, and then the second speaker got up. He said, "My name's Shaq, I'm an alcoholic." He said, "By the grace of God," he said, "I have 30 years this sober this January." And I thought, well, he must be suffering from brain damage. How can anyone get that? And he talked about the nature of this disease, and he said, you know, he spent his whole life trying to organize everyone else. They used to call him the drunken preacher in Beverly Hills. He knew all about God and the Bible, and he used to stand in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard preaching the gospel, put in and out of jail. Crazy man. And he finally got sober in 1946. And he said that this disease is a progressive, cunning, baffling, powerful, and it's terminal, and it kills you. And he said, it's all about surrender. He said, the moment you surrender, he said, and give up fighting everything and everyone, he said, he said, you'll find the good life. And he said, the moment he stopped looking for the $1 million, he made 10 million. The moment he stopped trying to travel around the world, he traveled around many, many times. The moment he stopped trying to run his family became a family without his help. And I thought, this really makes sense. I thought I was listening to Buddha. And the meeting ended, and I was introduced to Chuck, and he said, George introduced me, he said, "This is Tony, it's his first meeting." And Chuck put his hands on my shoulder, he said, "You just keep coming back," he said, "because we're the luckiest people in the world." He said, "We get better than better. We alcoholics are remarkable people." He said, "If you're in this organization and in this outfit, stay in." He said, "I highly recommend it." And he said, "If you do it," he said, "you'll find the good life." And I'm here to say that I have found the good life. I wouldn't say that it's Pollyanna or every day. No, it's not a bed of roses. Life is tough. Life is unfair. If it was fair, I should be dead years ago. There is no justice. If there was justice, I should have been dead years ago. I should have been in jail, in the booby hatch. Or I should have been in the insane asylum. But for some reason, beyond any of my knowledge, any understanding, I came to California in 1975, and for God knows what reason, ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I take it that my life is none of my business. The moment I make it my business, I'm in big trouble. Because I'm back in the squirrel cage. And every day I want to take it back. Every day I want to take it back. But that's okay, that's being human. You know, as Guy said, you know, you can't get rid of the human ego totally. We need some of that. It's the burr under the saddle that keeps us moving. We have to keep moving. We have to take actions. We have to make decisions. And they many times make wrong decisions. But at least we give it our best shot. And that's what Chuck used to say. Give it your best shot. Just give it the best you got. And I got over the years. I've met the most stunning people, you know, and I've been all over the place, all over the world. And I remember going to Australia and in Melbourne and going to a meeting and, you know, meeting a bunch of Australians in a room. But naturally, you meet a lot of Australians in Australia. Like my friend here. In New York. You know, meeting a lot of New Yorkers in a meeting. I don't know who they are. I go in, but within minutes I know what they are. Because we all have the X factor. Alcoholic. Drunk. Addict. And I'd always wanted, when I was a young actor, I always wanted to be an alcoholic. I thought it was so romantic, you know. I still love the word dipsomaniac. Alcoholic. I used to think it's such a gritty word to be an alcoholic. Little knowing that I was one. I'd like to say for the newcomer, or the guy who's just been here 6 days, that, or anyone new, or anyone old, that it's not the amount we drink, it wasn't the amount I drank, it was what it did to me. It was the effect it had on me. When I look at my wife, who is as peculiar to me as I must be to her, certainly her drinking avatar, I look at someone, and millions of people like her, who can do everything in sort of moderation. She has her little hang-ups, I guess, her little obsessions. Cleaning. Order. That's fine. Doesn't have to be put in jail for it. She bosses me about, she tells me what to wear, and I say, okay, fine. But that's her right, that's her privilege, and that's wonderful. And I love her for it. But looking at her, I think sometimes I ask her, how is it you can handle your life so well? She says, well, what's the problem? You know, she's getting older, me, I'm getting older, so if she wants to go on a diet, she'll just cut out certain foods. Me, I have to struggle and beat my brains out. She says, well, just cut down. I said, what do you mean, just cut down? Try chewing your food slower. I said, I can't, why? He'll tell you, I'm the fastest eater in the world. I gotta do my own stunts now, I don't. But that recent injury was a case in point of being an alcoholic. I think the greatest thing, and I feel inspired to say this, how much longer do I go on? So, well, I'll try and wrap it up some. Time for a coffee, actually. I think the greatest thing for us, and for me, is I'd always looked for the beautiful people. I'd always wanted the beautiful life, and I found it in Alcoholics Anonymous, in all shapes and sizes. Met the most remarkable people. I was talking to one this morning, is a 36-year-old con man, and he's still a con man. He was a drunk con man, now he's a sober con man. And I can see every move he makes. He says, hi, Tony, how you doing, huh? And I understand him. He's a sober horse thief. I love him for it. Because he can't stop doing what he does. And, you know, I know a couple of alcoholics who are gamblers. Can't stop gambling. But they're sober. And I've met, you know, aging hippies, like I feel like an aging hippie with his beard. And I have the most romantic life. I live a wonderful life. And every day I have to remember, because every day I'll grumble and I'll complain about this, that and the other. My leg is going to sleep. It's okay. And I'll complain about everything. But I have to remember all the time. And I've got a list of resentments in my head that'll take me back an elephantine memory for insults and sideswipes. But I have to remember that those can kill me. I heard a story, a guy called Clancy, you've probably heard his tapes, an extraordinary man. I was in a meeting in the Pacific Palisades last year. And Clancy runs the mission downtown Los Angeles for all the down and outs and the alcoholics on the streets. And their average is maybe 10% survivor. Most of them die. Clancy does this amazing job with them. And he was an alcoholic himself. He was an alcoholic himself, and he was sober, 19 years trying to get sober. And an amazing guy. And he and Chuck were very close friends. But I remember him saying, we had a meeting one morning, an early morning meeting in Pacific Palisades, last year something, I believe. And he said, my name's Clancy, and I'm an alcoholic. And he said, this room, he said, I used to come to this meeting. It was held on a Saturday morning here years ago. He said, my sponsor started this. He said, my sponsor saved my life, but my sponsor died drunk. He said, because they changed the seating arrangement without telling him. And although that was kind of funny, it was very sad. He said, because that's what gets us drunk. It's the snapping shoelace. It's the appointment that's not kept. The little tiny things. We can handle earthquakes, we can handle twisters, we can handle anything. But snapping shoelace or somebody looking at us from the passing bus can get us drunk. And all the ingredients of all the peculiarities that we are, all the weird stuff that makes all of us up, and certainly in my case I know the weird, strange things that go on in my mind, that I feel like a rich person because I've made friends with people who are, I'm the richest people in the world, I don't mean financially rich, just amazing people, power-packed people, ex-cons, people who were in jails, and I knew a guy in Los Angeles who was his last drunk was a shootout with the police, he and his wife, and they ended up in a big jail for 10 years, and he came out and reformed, sober alcoholic, and he's about 30 years sober now. His name is Woody, an amazing guy, and I've had the privilege of meeting people like that, and some of the old times. What I love about this meeting, I've only been here 3 times, it reminds me of the early days in Los Angeles when people used to smoke. I was in a meeting with Alex a couple of weeks ago, at a meeting up in Kissimmee, I think, and people were smoking. And I thought it was like the good old days. I don't smoke myself, and, you know, I don't like when it gets too smoky. But it kind of took me back 22 years ago. And I used to go to those meetings, some of those old-timers were there, sitting around the clubhouses playing cards. And these are the guys who saved my life. I remember going into the central office in my first week after being sober for 7 days, and I was feeling nervous one morning, and I was sitting in the coffee shop. My wife hadn't come back from England, and I was very nervous, and I was convinced I wouldn't be able to figure this program out. I'd failed at everything in my life, and I thought that I'd fail at this. I'm bound to screw this one up. So I walked down the street and went back into that central office that I told you about. And there's a man there called Dan. He's a big guy. He had tattoos all over him. And he was the last person on earth I wanted to see. And he said, "What can I do for you?" I said, "My name's Tony." He said, "My name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic." And he looked at me, a big head, big shoulders. He looked like a killer. I think he was a killer. He said, "How are you doing?" I said, "Got 5 days sober." And he gave me a big bear hug. I said, "I'm scared." He said, "You're scared?" "I'm scared." He said, "I'm always scared." I said, "You?" "Yeah." He said, "I'm an alcoholic." He said, "Everyone's scared." He said, "I'm scared." "So what? Come and have a coffee." And magical things like that. And he put me at my ease. And I realized that I didn't have to be John Wayne. Now, John Wayne had scripts, you know. He didn't have to be Humphrey Bogart, sort of looking cool or whatever. But that's what I tried all my life, to be like somebody else. You know, and I learned some lessons in this life that, a few lessons anyway, I hope. You know, I have a cat. It's quite content being a cat. It doesn't want to be a dog. You know, but me, I always want to be somewhere else. Look at a hummingbird. It doesn't want to be a crow. It's quite happy being a hummingbird. But we alcoholics always want to be somewhere else. But I really have to close now. I remember my first 2 years of sobriety. My wife and I drove down into Arizona. We bought a new car and we took off. And I'd been, this is alcoholic. And we got to the lip of the Grand Canyon. And we got up early sunrise to go and see the down into the Grand Canyon. And I looked down and I said, "Is that it?" Yeah. I thought it was deeper than that. It's not enough. Is that all it is? I guess that's why we drunk and we use drugs, because life is constantly disappointing us. We have such a lust for life, and life is constantly letting us down, so we commit suicide slowly on the installment plan. I guess that's what the dynamic is. We slowly commit suicide because we can't get enough of the elixir of life. Alcohol has been with us for thousands of years. It's used in religious ceremonies. We just about a little bit too much of God, I guess. But as they said, we look for God in the bottle. I was looking for God in the bottle, and I found some kind of peace of mind momentarily, and then it would turn round and zap me, and I had the tiger by the tail for all those years. And all I can say is, we're round out now, just going back to that little injury business I had a few weeks ago when I decided that I didn't need an operation. Only a couple of bullet wounds, so what? I got another leg. Chop this one off. I didn't. But the funny thing was, I was kind of excited by a future like that. I thought, this would be fun, this would be interesting. This would be really interesting, you know, to have a limp. Crazy, but it's interesting. At least we're alive. And I guess that's it. I love being here tonight, and I'm just sorry I'm so immobile and I can't move around much. But in my short stay here in Orlando, it's been a pleasure meeting you all and meeting some of you, and meeting you all tonight. I hope you get to say hello to you all. And to the newcomer and anyone having problems with alcoholism at the moment or recovery, just keep coming back. As I was told, just keep coming back. There was a guy called Milton, and he'd been sober many years, and he said, "How are you doing?" And I'd say, "Well, you know," he said, "just keep coming back." "Yeah, but just keep coming to meetings." "Yeah, but you just keep coming to meetings." And he tapped me on the head and said, "That's a very sick machine you got up there." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "That's a sick piece of machine you got up there." He said, "Just keep coming to meetings." He said, "Don't ask questions, leave all your thinking outside, because that's the thing that'll kill you. That'll kill you." He said, "Get your backside into the meeting, park it on the seat, shut up and listen. You know, take the cotton out of your ears." And he told me, he said, in the early days when he got sober, if he even dared to open his mouth when he was a newcomer, people would say, "Did you open, were you going to say something, you were going to put a donut in there? You've got nothing to say. You're a newcomer." He said, in those days they were really tough, and I had some tough sponsors in those days. Some of those old guys in Los Angeles and North Hollywood were the great guys, you know, who helped me. And I hope and pray that maybe my
humble words. I hope they've been made some sense to someone and will help. Because you certainly helped me tonight. Thanks a lot.